worst scientific team ever.
Hi, everybody. We'd love to get your feedback. You can post a review wherever you found this podcast. Find us on Twitter at RealDMC or send us a message at feedback@realdmc.com. If you send us some feedback, we may include it in our listener feedback section and you'll hear it on the show. Thank you for listening and now on to the episode.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Real DMC podcast. The DMC stands for Dave, Marcus, and Colin. I guess we will open on a slightly sad note. Bruce Willis has retired from acting due to aphasia, which is a bit of sad news because we all grew up watching his films, and he was, of course, John McClane in Die Hard, a film that is very close to all of our hearts, to the point that we actually end up sometimes dropping a Die Hard reference in any one of our various podcasts. And we do have a Die Hard podcast that we did that's dedicated to that film. That's a lot of fun, so would recommend if you have any interest in Die Hard to go back and listen to that one. But just a quick shout out to Bruce. Sorry to hear that news.
It is a bummer. Big time.
So moving on, so from our listener feedback, so we received a message from an Eric De Raven, which I assume is somebody who listened to our Crow podcast and was celebrating the way that Marcus was enjoying the pronunciation of that particular name. But they did ask a question. You guys haven't done a sports movie. What's the first one that comes to mind if you would want to do it?
I'd say Any Given Sunday. I haven't seen it in a long time, and I like Oliver Stone, and it's supposedly one of his better ones. So it'd be interesting to rewatch that one someday.
I will not do that one.
Right.
I cannot take the garish uniform colors in that movie. There's just, I will not assault my eyes with that anymore.
Is that LA Stallions or is that Last Boy Scout?
That's the Last Boy Scout. Much better
uniforms. That's an interesting thing. That's an interesting hill to die on, Colin, when it comes to a movie, honestly.
Why don't you watch Any Given Sunday and then let's talk.
I recall Any Given Sunday being pretty good, and that Al Pacino at least had a very inspirational speech as the coach at one point in that movie.
Yeah. I think I only saw it once, so it'd be interesting to rewatch.
It's good, but there's just stuff in there I just cannot take.
Yeah, all right. What about you, Dave?
I was thinking about it. Maybe off the top of my head, I'd say Major League from baseball, just because that's a pretty fun movie. And then I really do like the movie Tin Cup with Kevin Costner as a golfing movie. So
that's a good one.
That one is another one that comes to mind. Well, I don't know if anybody's asking us to do a sports movie, but maybe we'll think about that. It's my pick, and I don't think I'm heading in the sports movie direction. So, Marcus, Colin, it's over to you.
I wish Colin picked a sports movie last time.
Well, maybe we should just get into it then.
Well, the film we're here to talk about today is the massively disappointing Alien prequel, directed by Ridley Scott from 2012. Let's talk about Prometheus.
Ancient civilizations that were separated by centuries, and yet
this same pictogram was discovered in every one of them.
They're smiling.
I think they want us to come and find them.
We're all here because of a map you two kids found in a cave.
Not a map, an invitation.
From whom?
Please tell me you can read that.
Prometheus, are you seeing this?
Whatever that probe is picking up, it's reading life form.
What do you mean a life form?
Oh, the head.
They're changing.
Changing into what?
It's moving. These things moving.
What is that?
There's a ship.
They're leaving.
To go where?
Earth.
We were so wrong.
Take us home! If you don't stop it, there won't be any home to go back to.
So, Colin, you picked this movie. Why did you pick this movie?
I picked this movie for a couple of reasons. Now, I understand the reasons why you guys may not like this. And to be honest, same thing. I mean, first of all, I'll say why I like this. It's got stunning visuals. It's an alien prequel, or sort of prequel. It's got a really compelling story because it's sort of based on like a possible human origin story. But it does have these dumb characters, and that makes it really frustrating.
Not just dumb characters. I mean, the stupidest bunch of motherfuckers to ever be on a spaceship ever in any movie of all time. I mean, these guys are supposed to be scientists. I'm going to use scientists with air quotes there. I mean, come on. This is the character motivations and the character actions in this movie for like a big budget sci-fi movie and all the energy that you put into the visuals and the production design. The script for this movie is horrible. It's terrible. You have to admit that.
Absolutely. But this is why I wanted to do this movie, so we could like really delve into that stuff, because it is so head scratching. It is so dumb. Almost at every turn in the script, you're like, why are you doing that? However, that being said, it is beautifully made, stunning visuals. I love the surgery scene. I mean, the surgery is just amazing. And then the ending, the finale, with, you know, a huge spaceship rolling across the landscape. It's very memorable, and it makes me want to watch it over and over. And every time I do, I'm just like, what is wrong with you people? So that's kind of like why I wanted to do this.
Would you prefer the crew from Prometheus or the crew from Armageddon? Which is your which crew of man in your space flight?
I'll take Armageddon, because at least they have a
Armageddon
couple
team. Are you kidding me?
They have a couple of NASA astronauts. So
yeah, they do have some actual shuttle pilots on there. So
yeah.
So Colin, I have a theory. Okay. I have to think that Alien as a property, in terms of Alien and Aliens, so at least the first two movies, those are pretty significant movies for you personally. Would that be correct?
Certainly Aliens is, yeah. And I do love Alien as well. The rest of the franchise, not so much, but those two films I do love.
This is our second podcast on the Alien. We did go back and do Alien 3 also.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I did 45 minutes on Aliens during our 1986 movie podcast, so... Yeah, I love it. I think, you know, Alien is just an amazing horror movie. And then Aliens is an amazing action war movie. And they're both sci-fi, which I love.
Where would you classify Prometheus? It's listed as a like sci-fi horror. Do you think it gets there?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you guys. That was one of my questions, was, is this sci-fi or is it horror? And I know from myself what I think. And I don't think it's a horror at all. It should be, but there's nothing in this movie that really ramps up the tension. For me, the only scene that gets close is the surgery. What do you guys think?
There's not enough scares in it. There's not enough tension throughout. So there's a couple of like good scenes, but it's minimal. It's more almost just a straight sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean, this is stupid sci-fi, I guess is kind of how I'd characterize it. It's amazing to look at, but rewatching this movie, I've only seen this movie once before, and I remember, actually, so let's ask this question. So when you first saw this movie, what was your reaction to it, Colin?
I thought it was asking some very big questions, and it drew me in, and then almost immediately I kept going, wait, what? What are you doing? Like, why are you doing that? So I had mixed feelings about it. And yet I think what I remembered were the good things and not the bad things.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. Like, I kind of remember it. It didn't really stick with me. Like, I remember thinking it was like a pretty good movie, but I didn't really like, I don't think I thought too deep about it and just kind of like sat back and enjoyed the ride.
Yeah, I remember thinking this movie was very frustrating when I saw it. And that's, you're going to hear a lot of that echoed in terms of my rewatch, in terms of having the same sort of experience. Because the idea of Ridley Scott going back to the Alien franchise and the Alien property was very exciting to me, because I do think Ridley Scott's a pretty great director. And I think the original Alien is a really great film. But then it seems like this whole movie is, it sets up an explanation for why you see the space jockey in the chair for the original Alien. I mean, that's kind of what you end up getting out of this movie. And that seems to me to be just a waste of an entire film, especially with the visuals and the production design and the actors and the cast in this film. You have some high-powered resources and, you know, people that are obviously very talented in terms of what they do. But to do all that and put all that together and then have such a stupid script with characters making the most asinine decisions out of any kind of like big budget film that I can think of, maybe Armageddon actually is an interesting comparison, because I remember the scene in Armageddon where they land on the asteroid, and like suddenly there's a guy that has a Gatling gun. There's a Gatling gun on one of the moon rovers or whatever. Like, it's, I mean, and honestly, at the time, I would have thought, okay, Armageddon was the stupidest thing I've ever seen as a big budget movie. Prometheus rivals Armageddon in terms of the level of logic and decision making. It's you could argue which of those two. Maybe Armageddon is actually the characters make the more reasonable decisions. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I didn't come out of like my first time watching it for sure, and even this time, like I haven't seen Armageddon in a long time, but I remember walking out of Armageddon thinking like, oh, that was just so ridiculous. And this one, I think my views are not quite that. It's not that ridiculous. It's just bad. Like it doesn't come together well. It's maybe a better way.
No, it's frustrating. That's the word that I would use to describe this movie.
What's so frustrating?
Because there are so many great elements here, right? There is actually an interesting, you know, overall concept. The production design, it, you know, the suit design, the vehicles, the ships, it looks great. The visuals, all the visuals where they're in the interior of the pyramid and you see the alien technology and the holograms that are getting created. That's all very compelling and really interesting visually, but then to wrap that, like, or to put all that level of effort into a script that this is stupid, it's just dumb. I mean, it's a waste of talent is what this movie is.
Yes. I mean, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, the script history is kind of interesting, and we'll get into that. I feel like they started out to make one film, which was a straight up alien prequel, and then they decided to go in a different direction, and they wanted it to become its own movie. And maybe that's where some of that lies. I mean, you know, I said, like, it's not a horror film, and yet you've got characters that are doing things that you would expect people to do in a horror film. Like, Fifield and Milburn are essentially dumb teenagers in this movie. That's the way they behave.
Yeah, they're basically the stoner couple that is killed by the machete-wielding Jason in one of those Friday the 13th movies. I mean, that's the level of logic they're using here.
Right. And yet, there's nothing then to sort of support that. There is no boogeyman, really, at that point in the film. And maybe that's why you've got such idiocy going on. But it's not just them. You know, there are other characters that we'll get into. Like, why are they doing that? But yeah, I think it was potentially a fantastic movie that didn't make it there because they spent a lot of time writing this film too. So I'm very actually surprised that it was so poorly written.
And it's also not like the writer is actually a talented writer too. He wrote, John Spates is the lead writer, I believe. And he wrote like Dune. Like he wrote the screenplay for Dune.
Yeah, but you know that.
Well, I thought Damon Lindelof was one of the main writers on Prometheus, though.
They were both listed.
Yeah, Spates wrote the original screenplay, and then Lindelof came in, and they wanted to take it in a different direction, which they did. Spates wrote the original Alien prequel, and then Lindelof and Ridley Scott wanted to make it into its sort of its own property, so it was not going to be a direct sequel. And they, you know, Ridley Scott, I think, wanted to do multiple sequels and sort of make this his franchise.
Yeah, he's still got one more in the work, too.
Well, we don't really know because the studio really cooled off after Alien Covenant, which is the sequel to this movie.
Yeah.
And Alien Covenant ended up really not answering a lot of the questions that Prometheus posed, and it was not that good. And I think a third sequel is now, you know, maybe it'll happen sometime, but there are no plans right now for it, which is, you know, it's really disappointing because I thought they could have had a really great, like a three movie arc that does lead into Alien. But basically they didn't want to have the end of this movie end up being, you know, what happens right before Alien. I mean, you watch the movie and at the end, you know, when the space jockey comes up out of the floor in the engineer's control room, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is it. Like now we're going to see like what happens to, you know, the space jockey, and he's going to, you know, be sitting there and there's going to be a chest burster and there's going to be egg sacs all around, right? That's going to be the derelict spacecraft, but that's not what happens. So it's a completely different movie. And then at the end, I'm asking myself questions. Well, how do they then get from that point to, you know, the beginning of Alien?
Yeah.
And I thought that the next movie and maybe the next movie after that, we're going to, answer that question. Alien Covenant did not answer that question. And I don't think that they're probably ever going to answer that question, because they didn't want to answer that question with this movie. Like, they purposely decided not to have that ending, because I think, as I don't know if it was Damon Lindelof or Ridley Scott said, you know, there's no point in making a movie where everyone knows what the ending is. That doesn't make for a good story. And I thought, well, that's interesting.
I think Rogue One would be a good counter to that.
That's the movie I immediately thought of. Was like, yeah. Bullshit. Because that was fantastic.
Exactly.
So by way of general introduction, so the film does maintain a, in my opinion, shocking 7.0 on the IMDb. I was pretty surprised by this, honestly, because I looked at Alien at least, and that was, so Alien is 8.5, and maybe if Alien is 8.5, then I still think 7.0 as a comparison is too high. So I honestly do not get the high score for this movie.
I get it. I understand it. I actually agree with it.
Really?
Yeah, because I think that if they had fixed those script issues, it could be like an 8.5.
If they had fixed the script issues, are you kidding me?
They redid the whole script.
Just because something is pretty to look at, it doesn't make it a good movie.
I think it's not just that it's pretty to look at. I think it's a really compelling story, and it asks a lot of really big questions that I'm interested in myself.
Yeah, I think they just messed it up too bad, though. Like,
well, like, all I can say is I've watched this movie now probably about 3 or 4 times, and I keep thinking about it. It's like a bad ex-girlfriend.
Well, sorry, that's an interesting analogy. Okay. It was made for a budget of anywhere between 120 to 130 million, depending on where you look at it. Apparently, and Scott was asking for a budget of $250 million originally to make his film. So I am kind of curious to see what the $250 million version of this film would have been. Colin, any info on what it was that they cut or changed to, you know, represent the $120 million difference?
I think he wanted it to be more like Alien. He wanted it to be quite scary, and he wanted it to be for adults, and the studio balked at that. And so in order to get the R rating, he could only get half the budget. So I am interested to see like what that, you know, extra $120 million was going to go for.
Yeah, the film was, I guess, a financial success ultimately. It made $126 million at the U.S. box office and made $403 million worldwide. Apparently there was some contention between Scott and the studio in terms of the gore. Were they actually trying to push this? Was the studio trying to push this down to a PG-13? Was that their intent? Do you know?
Yeah, they were. PG-13 means more butts in the seats and money.
Yeah, bigger audience.
Oh, so from a critical standpoint, the film definitely received mixed reviews, mixed to negative. I think I'd have to look at it. I think the Rotten Tomato score was like 56.
No,
it was
like 73%.
So it was 73%? Okay. Yeah.
But the funny thing is, many of the reviews that liked them had like critical things to say about it. So like one was, and this was from a positive review, "Many walked into this movie expecting a science fiction thriller in the vein of Ridley Scott's original Alien. This, I feel, was a colossal mistake." So the review is basically saying that if your mindset was this is going to be another Alien, that was a mistake coming in with that mindset. The movie is something different. But I think that's where they set you up to... That's what you expected, though, I think, right? It's Ridley Scott. It's an Alien franchise.
That's really interesting because... I think Ridley Scott purposely did not want this to be another Alien film. In fact, he purposely did not want to have the xenomorph in this film. He really wanted to distance it from Alien and Aliens and the franchise. He, like I said, it really originally started off as a prequel, but then they tried to make it into its own movie that was, I guess, Alien adjacent. Or I think they kept saying they wanted it to be in the Alien universe, but it's not like a direct, it doesn't have a direct relationship with Alien.
Yeah.
Which I find to be just bullshit because it does have a direct relationship with it, but it's just a couple steps away.
Well, it's I think they're divorcing it from that one, like Ripley basically, right? It's not a Ripley story. This is just somewhere else in the universe. Like, yeah, it's still Wayland Enterprises or whatever. Wayland Corporation. but it's somewhere else in the universe and something else that they're doing, not that same mission.
And that's fine.
They pull a shit ton of references from the other Alien films, right? Which is and they kind of jam those down your throat a little bit when you're watching this. I mean, there are callbacks to the way characters act. There are very similar visuals, and of course, what I find interesting about this movie, I guess a spoiler alert if you haven't seen it, but you know they show effectively a version of the xenomorph. What, like the last 15 seconds of this film before it ends, and then it just, you know, and then it goes to the credits. So that to me is even actually kind of a strange choice, because if you had people that were there, if you had a certain segment of the population that was coming to see what they hoped was going to be something similar to the Alien, or at least the Alien experience they got when Ridley Scott directed the earlier film, you know, to have that as a last second kind of tack on, it's just there, and then you go to the credits. I don't know, that seems a little bit, I could see where if you were a fan, you'd be like, well, fuck, there's the Alien I came to see. And then, okay, credits. Now I'm walking out to my car, right? Yeah. So I just, you know, I could see where a lot of people would be frustrated by that. It's kind of like, you know, my comparison would be the Halloween 3 situation where Michael Myers was not in the film. You know, that would be an example of where it's just the expectations of the audience were not in line with what actually the film was.
No, I completely understand that. And I felt that same way when watching this the first time. And thinking, again, that, you know, the space jockey, well, it wasn't the same space jockey. You know, why isn't this ship going to crash on LV-426? Why aren't they on LV-426? And then that alien that comes out at the very end, that doesn't look like the alien that I'm used to. So I had all these questions, lots and lots of questions, and I had to figure it out. I kept thinking about it. It's not the same movie, but I want to know more. And I think that's probably the most important thing, is that I saw the movie, I liked it, I did feel frustrated, but I wanted to know more, which meant that I was going to buy a ticket for the next movie.
And then unfortunately you got Alien Covenant.
Yes.
All right, Colin, anything you'd like to say about the legacy?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting because, I mean, it's a great, if you think about it, it's a pretty great franchise, except that...
Is it though?
That's what I'm saying. Like, it should. Well, I guess what I mean is it should be a great.
Is it a
franchise.
Great? Is it a great IP and a shitty franchise? Would that be a better way to say
that
it?
That might be a better way, because it started off like incredibly strong, Alien and Aliens, and then Alien 3. You know, we did a podcast on that. It came out in '92, and it's a lot better than I had remembered. And so I don't think it's really that bad. It's just got a whole lot of shit. And then Alien Resurrection, which is not, it's a weird movie. It was given to the wrong director.
Right, you don't think the director of Amelie should be directing an Alien movie?
Did he do that?
Yeah, Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
Oh, okay. So I know him from...
He did Delicatessen.
City of Lost Children?
Yeah. I think so.
Weird choice. It looks like a Jeunet movie, but... It should be an alien movie anyway. And then, you know,
wait, actually, one quick question though. So straight up, what's a better movie, Alien 3 or Prometheus?
Prometheus.
Oh, I'd go Alien 3, dude.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Alien 3 has its issues too. I'd probably say Alien 3.
Alien 3, if you're looking for a straight, so Alien 3 is a lot more like Alien. Whereas Prometheus, I think, is a different movie on its own. And so if I had to compare the two, yeah, I Prometheus for me. Not by much, but yeah, no, I like it better. And then you got the prequels, you know, Prometheus and Alien Covenant. Alien Covenant, I watched again. Okay, I mean, I have things to say about that. If you want to talk about frustrating, that movie's pretty frustrating. But there's still stuff there. There's still some good stuff there.
Yeah, my quick take on that movie is that the studio said, "Hey, Ridley, we need more aliens, we need more gore, we need it to be a little bit scarier, or something that people think is very similar to the original Alien." And so that movie actually feels like a horror movie to me for the most part, the way that it's shot, and I think it's fairly unsatisfying. That's how I describe it. And also, you know, David's motivations for committing genocide on the engineer planet are a little bit in question for me.
Yeah, we'll talk about David, but yeah, I feel like Covenant was not the sequel that Prometheus promised.
Yeah.
It was almost like we're going to spend $100 million and phone it in and give the studio what they want, which is, again, a bunch of dummies out in space doing dumb things. And then you got these crossover films, Alien vs. Predator and Alien vs. Predator Requiem, which I have never seen and I don't really care to see. I just feel like they shouldn't even be there.
Actually, I'll say this. Alien vs. Predator is maybe better than you would expect. It's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it's okay. And I would say that you actually can't see Aliens vs. Predator Requiem if you tried, because the way that film is lit, I mean, I swear to God, you can't see anything. That's the darkest movie I've ever seen in my entire life. I have no idea what's going on when you try to watch that movie. Yeah. And it's not good by any stretch of the imagination. So, it's a good idea to skip on those, I guess.
Yeah. Now, I did read just recently that Fede Alvarez is going to do a standalone film in the Aliens universe. There's not much information, but I'm excited. I mean, I really like
it. I'm 100% on board with that.
Yeah.
Go Fede Alvarez.
Yeah. That should be really, really interesting.
He'll go horror. If you want gore in a horror movie, he's the one.
Oh, man, I'd love to see an Alien film directed by him, actually.
Yeah, totally. And give him budget. Oh. Just give him some budget. Maybe this isn't even necessary, but do you have a favorite of this whole franchise?
I would say Aliens.
Yeah, it's Aliens. It's Aliens for me by a mile, honestly.
Yeah. That's the one I kind of was introduced to. That's the one I kind of grew up with. The action movie, you know, it's just fantastic.
That was a first date movie for me. So it's important.
Jesus Christ, man.
I always go for the rom-com. Hey, you want to go see a movie? What do you want to see? Aliens. It's true. It was a first date movie for me. I basically forgot I was sitting next to a girl that I was interested in because I was so into the movie.
Well, Aliens is also mine. I don't want to say it's by a mile because Aliens is so great, but they're two different movies.
Yeah.
But Alien is so great too. For the first time I saw Aliens, I went with my mom and a friend when I was 15, and my mom grabbed my hand halfway through the movie, and she like never let go. that was my mom was my date for that movie.
Nice. That was a bonding moment for you. Okay, anything you want to cover in regards to production notes?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting that it had a pretty long development cycle, because originally in the early 2000s, James Cameron wanted to do a prequel with Ridley Scott, which I think would have been like really great.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with this.
Yeah. James Cameron and Ridley Scott were going to do a prequel. And then Cameron ended up dropping out because of the Alien versus Predator films, and which he said would kill the validity of the franchise, which I agree. Like this is why I never watched those movies. But in 2009, Ridley Scott picked it up again, right? And so this is where John Spates wrote the original script, and then Ridley Scott wanted to take it into a different direction. That's why he hired Damon Lindelof. And there you go. They just decided it was not going to be a direct prequel to Alien.
Do you know what the scope of the original prequel was, the Spates?
Yeah, there's a lot of elements in this movie, in Prometheus, but the ending is much different. A lot of the same characters. But the end of the movie does end with the space jockey. It ends the way that you see at the beginning of Alien with the derelict spacecraft. It all takes place on LV-426. In Prometheus, it's a different moon. It's LV-223, I think it is.
Director's Corner.
All right, well, moving on to Ridley Scott. Are you guys big fans of Ridley Scott? Colin?
No. Yes, of course.
So what are your favorite Ridley Scott films?
I think number one's probably Blade Runner, and number two, very close second, is Alien. And then I'm going to go Gladiator and The Martian.
Yeah, that's my list. I would actually add Black Hawk Down as maybe my fifth favorite Ridley Scott film.
No Black Rain?
I do love the karaoke sequence in Black Rain, but...
See the girl with the red dress on.
Maybe not the overall film. Michael Douglas' hair in that film, there's something not right with it.
I need to rewatch that one. I still can't believe it's a Ridley Scott film. We had it at Century Almaden. That's the only reason anybody even knows that movie.
But yeah, I have to say, I mean, I love Ridley Scott. There's so many of his movies, and I think he's just an amazingly impressive director. And he has created these entire, like Gladiator's a good example of where he created a whole reality. And if you look at the production of that film, just the artistry and the scope and all that. And so that's why when I see Prometheus and the end result, I'm confused, because I can't believe that Ridley Scott as a director would make this movie, would sit and watch this movie and would say, oh, this is a good movie. It just, I mean, it seems like it's a massive quality drop off from a lot of his other films. That's just my opinion.
He was 74 when he made it, so give him a break.
I'm going to blame Damon Lindelof, because I feel like this is sort of like the curse of Lost, where it really is a fascinating idea, and they pose so many just crazy questions, and it sucks you in, and then ultimately it just doesn't deliver.
And then you end up with a smoke monster tornado, and you're very disappointed, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. Marcus, any thoughts on Ridley Scott?
No more. No, I'd say about the same list of movies. I have Black Hawk Down probably a little bit higher. I haven't seen The Martian. I read the book, but I'm sure it's great.
So if you could only have one Scott Brothers filmography or catalog question. Of films to look at, would you take Tony Scott or Ridley Scott?
I would probably take Tony Scott, because I think I like his movies a little bit more. But Ridley Scott does a wider range of movies. So like Tony does primarily action movies, and he does them really well. Whereas Ridley has a wide range. Like, he's done Thelma and Louise. He does war movies, sci-fi movies. He'll do, like, American Gangster is another one of Ridley Scott's. So
yeah, that's actually a really good movie.
Yeah. So it's really hard to say, like, Ridley Scott, like, if it's, like, Desert Island type things, probably Ridley Scott, because there's just more variety. But I would say most of Tony Scott films I rank probably a bit higher. Like, True Romance is one of my favorite movies of all time. I think Tony's just have a lot more fun to him.
Colin?
This is fucking Sophie's choice. I don't know. depends on my mood for the day, I guess, really.
Yeah, if it was going to be a true Desert Island situation, I would almost go maybe Tony Scott just for the pure entertainment value of his films. But I do think that, honestly, my preference would probably be Ridley Scott, just because I think Tony Scott makes these... I think he's a very impressive director and has made these really interesting, fun movies that are really well-developed. But I would say that Ridley Scott is maybe more of the artist of the two of them, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. It's a good example, because like Ridley Scott's definitely the better director. Like, if you're thinking about like important and serious movies, Ridley Scott's clearly the better of the two directors in that regard. But Tony's movies are so great and fun. Like, right? It's very like, it's more action movies, more like, he's not intending them to be like these fine art movies.
No, they're fun.
Yeah.
Come on, Marcus. You know it's Tony Scott just for the fan.
The Hunger.
Days of Thunder.
Days of Thunder is fun. I go back and watch it. It's a good movie.
Days of Thunder is fun.
Yeah.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's a good example. It's like it's a legitimately entertaining movie. It's fun. Not a great movie, but a fun movie.
That's the thing. Like, Ridley Scott tends to make great movies, whereas Tony's tend to be fun.
Yeah, that's a good way to break it up.
Casting call.
Okay, so moving on to cast. We have, is it Noomi Rapace? Is that how you pronounce her?
Sure. Is it? Sure it is.
No, honestly, how is it? I mean, I looked it up actually before we did this, and I saw her in an interview.
That's how I pronounce it, but I don't know if that's actually correct.
So she plays Elizabeth Shaw. I don't have a lot to say about her as an actor in terms of her other films. I know that she was in the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trilogy, I believe.
Yeah,
but the original one, right? Like
the original
Swedish version, yeah. Which I've seen, and I actually have seen that whole series, and I really like her. I like her a lot in this role. I think she's really good. I think, unfortunately, that they didn't give her a lot to work with. Obviously, when we're talking about characters, it's really only in the third act that she has a chance to shine, and that's to me where it counts.
Yeah, I mean, I think the performance is good. I think the material she's given to work with is pretty bad.
Yeah.
And I do have some... she has amazing stamina for somebody that has their abdomen cut open. Oh, and then God. She can, you know, she can be repelling, you know, 2 minutes later and all that kind of stuff. So she's certainly is at least representing Shaw as being quite the warrior woman. So
my wife's had 2 C-sections, and she was not doing anything like that. Afterwards,
hey, it's 2093. They got good drugs.
No, that's true. Actually, medical technology has advanced.
You don't need those stomach muscles, no.
you just don't feel the pain.
So you have Michael Fassbender as David. I actually think Michael Fassbender. So first of all, I'm a big Michael Fassbender fan in general. I really like him as an actor. I think his performance as David is really interesting, fairly compelling, definitely weird. Brings back a lot of the kind of that Ian Holm energy from the first Alien in terms of the, you know, the weirdness of the android and some of the the slightly like kind of slightly disconnected, but there's a little bit of menace in almost everything that David does.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting performance, and he's fun to watch here. But his motivations in terms of then the actions that he takes, again, lots of head scratching there in terms of what he's doing. And also, if he was who he was as a character and was interacting with all the other characters on the ship, I think they would beat him to death within like 10 minutes of waking up. Because, I mean, you're looking at this guy, you're like, this guy's an albino freak show. Like, I don't know what your deal is, but you're weirding me out and I don't like you, so we need to kill you. That's my thought would happen when the crew would interact with this guy.
He's not an albino. He's just blonde. He just wants to be Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
But David's a very interesting character. I think his performance is pretty chilling, which is why I think you're right. People would just want to beat him to death. Or at least, like, you know, run up behind him and turn off his power button.
Yeah, hit the off switch. Yeah.
I mean, this is a situation where you've got artificial intelligence who develops the worst emotions that a human has. I think he's jealous of humans. And the problem is that he's superior to humans in almost every way, but they treat him like he's just a servant. And that's dangerous to have.
Yeah.
You got a superior being that you treat like shit that is mad at you. And of course, Holloway, you know, bears the brunt of that. Yeah. I think his character is so interesting, especially considering the fact that he's so much like humans. I mean, he was created by humans to be like humans. But he does not want to be like them. I don't think he considers himself to be another superior form of life. And that's very different than you see androids in a lot of other movies, where androids want
usually they're like, yeah, they're curious about humans and how can I become a human? And like,
exactly.
They're studying them. And it's, he doesn't have that same vibe.
No, he does not.
I liked him a lot. I thought he had the great, like, he's one of my favorite characters in the movie, just from his, like, he's just so creepy. He's kind of captivating to watch every time he's on screen. You kind of don't know what he's going to do. And it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's a great performance. My question ultimately is, after this happened, after the you know, the trip in Alien with the android going psychotic on that one, so who's basically looking at the android performance record and going, we need more of these guys out there?
To be fair,
what does Bishop say? The such and suches were a little bit twitchy, whatever their model number was.
Oh, the 9000s. Now, to be fair, David was the first of his kind. So he preceded Ash. Interesting that you bring them up, because Michael Fassbender avoided watching the synths from the Alien films Bishop and Ash. Instead, he studied the replicants of Blade Runner, especially Rachel, whose vacancy and longing for a soul interested him. Yeah. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but, you know, like Ridley Scott directed Blade Runner, and there's a lot of these same questions. So I think this is something that that really interests him, Ridley Scott.
Yeah, Fassbender and the visuals are the two things that really make this movie at least interesting.
Yeah,
in my opinion, I think his performance is really great.
But you know, I mean, David is a really, I think he's a psychopath.
Oh, I think so. I mean, at least a sociopath for sure, right?
Can an android be a sociopath?
Yes, I think David proves that.
Well, I wonder if they aren't they by default? I guess because would they be? I guess they don't.
Well, they don't have any empathy. That's true.
If he has no emotion, he has no empathy, right? So he would be a
All very interesting.
So you have a Charlize Theron as Meredith Vickers, and apparently, by the way, she was originally cast as Shaw, so she was going to play the primary role, but then she had scheduling conflicts, but then her schedule opened up a little bit, so they were able to cast her as this Vickers character. I think, you know, her performance is it feels very forced to me. Like, they're trying to give her a little bit of the Ripley, like, I'm a bit of a badass edge to her. In fact, there's a scene where you know, after she gets out of her pod, one of the first things she does is push-ups, very similar to what Vasquez did in Aliens when she gets out of her sleeping pod. So that's an example of where one of the places where I think they were trying to call back to it. But the Vickers character in this film is and the motivations around that character in particular are bizarre. And also the command structure in terms of what she can and can't direct the team to do, totally in question. So I think the Vickers character, I don't even know why you need them in this movie, honestly. Yeah,
that was my thought too. Like it seemed like completely a useless role in the movie. It just seemed like it was filler. You could have done the same sort of exposition or command or structure with just, what's his name? Janik, Idris Elba's character. He could have been the same role because he was captain of the ship. Like it just seemed like there was way too many managers. I don't know. maybe it's accurate. I mean, it's like the corporate structure of
women. Corporate America, middle management.
Like, oh, we got it. Like she got a promotion and she wanted to go on this thing. So we're going to include her. So like,
yeah, well, there's two things there that I totally agree with. You know, the organization structure on this ship is non-existent, and I don't understand why there needs to be someone who is in charge, and there is not. But why is Vickers there? The only reason I can say is that she's the company man. She represents Wayland, Wayland Industries or Wayland Corporation, whatever it is. Other than that, what does she do other than like lurk in the background and seem sinister? That's kind of it. And I mean, maybe there is a thing we find out near the end that she's actually Wayland's daughter, but who cares?
Yeah. Who cares? What's the point? Yeah, I mean, the Vickers character in this film is completely pointless. You could pull out Vickers and have no, I mean, I guess the other thing that they use her for is the exposition to show that she has a lifeboat, something that can be ejected from the ship, which they do use at one point. But that seems like it's a real stretch to have a character there just to justify that piece of action in the film.
You could have done that with the captain also, right? Like it's...
Yeah.
I think it's just a red herring. So she's like the company man. She's the Burke character from Aliens. You need that sinister Weyland Yutani corporate asshole to be there, but she ends up not quite being that character. And why is she leading this anyway? Because she obviously doesn't believe in this mission. She doesn't think they're going to find anything.
Right. And who's running Weyland Yutani for the 2.5 years or I guess the 5 years, if you count, that they're going to go out and back while this is happening.
Yeah, you're right.
So, and I guess the frustration there is I like Charlize Theron quite a bit. I think she's a very good actor, but it's just a pointless role here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing against Charlize. I love her a lot,
right.
But, I will say that for all of the actors, in this movie, it's nothing against them. It's this script, except for our next actor, Logan Marshall Green, who plays Charlie Holloway. I'm sorry, Logan, but you were given terrible material and you didn't do anything to help out.
Well, it's not, I can't separate his acting versus what the script is asking his character to do, because he might be the worst scientist I've ever seen on film.
He is the most annoying character in this film. I think you're probably right about the scientist thing.
His character motivations are so all over the place and so manic and strange that it doesn't really make any sense, honestly. His character is very, very strange.
Yeah, one of the trivia notes says that Logan Marshall Green described his role as of Charlie Holloway as an ESPN X Games scientist who leaps before he looks.
That's basically it. Yeah.
Now the question
another reason why you needed a command structure on this ship, by the way, it's just people, because everyone just does what they want. It's like you travel 2.5 years, hypersleep, go to a planet, discover alien existence, and at that point, it's just everybody just do whatever you want, have a good time.
Yeah. The question I had was like, was he directed to have that outlook? Like, was he told like, okay, your character is a X Games scientist? Or did he just wing it and be like, okay, this is where I'm going to take the character?
Well, I feel like I think it's probably half and half. I think he played it up, and what he played up made the character extremely annoying. He could have been sort of a risk-taking scientist in the risk-taking way that Indiana Jones is. But this is not Indiana Jones, okay?
That's who I want in my $1 trillion space exploration project.
I want somebody who's going to leap before they look.
I mean, the whole idea that you spend $1 trillion to go 327 trillion miles and you just get a bunch of dum-dums.
Dipshits. That's the word you're looking for.
I don't understand it.
Movie is so fucking maddening, dude. I mean, honestly, it's like...
This character...
Everybody throws the scientific method out the window right away. Nobody's doing... I mean, it's... Are you really going to spend this amount of money and this effort to go this distance and find this amazing discovery only to have these assholes act like they do? I mean, come on.
What other scientist do you know who's going to leap before they look? None.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that when we get to the walkthrough.
Moving on with dead scientists, maybe.
So you have Idris Elba as Janik, and you know I'm a huge Idris Elba fan, right? I love him as an actor, and he's very compelling on screen no matter what he's in. And I do like the bit of the hotshot pilot captain, you know, archetype that they give him to play here, and what they give him to do, which is not a ton, I think he does, you know, does fine with or does well with the character. Again, even, you know, the captain is making some very questionable decisions over the course of this. There's not a single character in this film that is, you know, acting like a reasonable person would. Idris Elba's fun. And I'm glad he gets to bang Vickers. I mean, congratulations. At least he got that before he had to commit suicide at the end there.
Stringer Bell. He's gonna get it done. He made pretty decent decisions. Like, he didn't let you're not getting on back on board the ship. He's like... You know, he was going to take off and nuke the site from orbit if he could. Like, right, that was his...
Right.
He seemed to be the one of the wiser... Like, I'm not saying he was great. It seems like he didn't have complete control of the situation also. So I think he was like... He's like, oh, wait, you can't go out there. We need to, like, assess the area and figure out, like, we just landed. You can't just go rushing out into this cave we just found. But then, like, he didn't have any juice to back it up or something. I don't know. Like, he spoke well, but then everyone just like, yeah, whatever, we're going.
And then to close out the cast, you have a largely wasted Guy Pearce as Peter Weyland. I do think that the makeup that they give him is a little over the top and doesn't look particularly good. So I'm not sure Guy Pearce is rocking the old man makeup effectively in this movie.
So here's what sucks about this is that Ridley Scott had his heart set on having Max von Sydow play Weyland. And I think that would have been brilliant. I would have loved that. I love Max von Sydow. So seeing him as Weyland would have been so great. But then Damon Lindelof came along and he wrote a scene where I think it was maybe a dream or something. It was definitely a flashback. And you see a young Weyland. And so because of that, they ended up getting Guy Pearce. And they just said, well, we can... Because this is before the technology that they have now where they can, you know, make someone look a lot younger. But... They ended up cutting that scene. And so you never see a young Weyland in this movie. So they could have had von Sydow. Just, that's disappointing.
Yeah. Well, and as a big Guy Pearce fan, I feel that he's largely wasted here.
Well, now you do get to see him in the opening scene of Alien Covenant as a young man. So I guess there's that. That is part of the viral marketing, was a young Peter Weyland.
Yeah, I think that's like what led to disappointment too, right? You see, Ridley Scott, and he has Charlize Theron and Idris Elba and Guy Pearce. You're expecting like, oh, this will be awesome. This will be fantastic.
And Fassbender. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you put, like, if you were going to tell me, hey, Ridley Scott is making a movie in the Alien universe and he has Fassbender, Charlize Theron, you know, Idris Elba, Guy Pearce. I'll even throw in Benedict Wong because I think he, you know, I like Benedict Wong. Yeah. I'm like, wow, I'm there.
Yeah.
And then this is what you get. So it's just, you know.
Yeah, so I think it's like somewhat the expectations too, right? Like if this was not an alien movie and this was just a sci-fi movie, like if you cut out the last 5 minutes with the alien, it's hard to judge that way though too, right?
Yeah. All right, Marcus, do you have a plot summary for us?
I do. A group of extreme scientists travel to a distant moon in search of mankind's origin. However, they were not prepared for the unimaginable horror that awaits them.
I'm sorry, I need to correct that a little bit. I think what you were looking for was extremely stupid scientists.
Opening questions.
I got one first. Is Prometheus a Christmas movie? Opens up a Christmas. Janet comes out with his Christmas tree.
Yes, there's a Christmas tree. It's a Christmas movie.
It is now for me. It's a Christmas movie. Hey kids, let's unwrap gifts and then gather around the TV for a screening of Prometheus.
All right, go ahead, Colin.
All right. They travel 327 trillion miles in under 2.5 years, which roughly translates to about 15 billion miles an hour, which is like 15 times the speed of light. When I saw that, I was just like, wait a minute, this is only about like 70 or 80 years from now, from when it was made. I found that to be unrealistic. I couldn't wrap my mind around the fact that...
Considering you can't go faster than the speed of light, it's not possible.
That's the thing. So do you believe that humans will develop faster than light technology in the next 80 years?
No.
No, of course not.
Okay.
I mean, 80 years from now, the planet's going to be collapsing. And some people are just going to be trying to survive. And by the way, I've seen where that goes. It usually leads to people fighting for water and or gasoline. So that's what people are going to be doing in 80 years.
But... Now, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, Star Trek, you know, they have FTL. Do you think that that's something that, you know, given the pace that we develop technology, there are things today that, you know, if you, 80 years ago, you'd never would have, you'd been like, what is that? It's magic.
No, I still think.
We don't have the cooperation and we're not leaning in the direction of actually science being an important thing in the world. So,
yeah, unfortunately,
I don't think that far. I just say, like, from physics standpoint, I don't think it's going to be possible.
Well, I guess once we learn how to fold space, right?
Yeah, then is that truly faster than light speed, or is that just, you know, using a wormhole somehow or folding space somehow?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, I was just sort of like stunned by the sheer scope when you think about, you know, the number of miles. 327 trillion, that's a long way. Of course, Vickers says, when she's like flirting with Janik, she says, why would I fly 500 million miles from Earth if I wanted to get laid? And I'm just like, can you please, like, you're leading this mission. You don't even know how far away you are. good Lord.
Well, I have one slightly maybe tangential question to that, which is, what is the status of alien life discovery within this universe, within the Prometheus timeline?
This is a great question. I have this question myself, because if you watch this movie, you would sort of assume that they've discovered aliens, you know, that they know that there's alien life out there, and they've met aliens, because they don't seem very excited when they find out. Yeah,
everyone is extraordinarily casual about, like, oh, look at this. Alien, you know, the aliens built these pyramids and alien technology. And even when there's an alien creature that shows up that they treat as a pet at one point in the movie, it's everyone's very, very just insanely casual about that. So I assume that somewhere earlier within the timeline, they must have made some discovery to assume that they are not the only ones in the universe. I don't know, because... Otherwise, from a science standpoint, seeing those pyramids on the planet would be a huge monumental moment in humanity, right? Just like, wow, we're not alone and all that. But everyone's like, eh, whatever, there's some pyramids. Let's go down there and just drive in and see what we can find. I mean, it's just like, it's like a Thursday.
Also,
I
mean, and yet, when they were flying in and Holloway sees like the lines, the straight lines.
Yeah, he has that stupid line.
Right there. God does not build in straight lines. Starboard side!
Right.
So well, bad. Some of the dialogue was so terrible. Oh, man.
Right. But he actually seemed like he was sort of halfway there. Like, oh, my God, this is a momentous thing.
This is first contact. Yeah.
Nobody else is behaving that way. Compare this to, like, a Spielberg film, where it would be, like, this amazing moment of awe.
Right.
Oh, my God. We're meeting... the first signs of intelligent life outside of our own solar system. And they just blow it off. Like it's like you said, like it's Thursday.
Have you seen Close Encounters recently?
No, but it's one of my favorites.
It's so good. Like rewatch it. It still holds up completely. Even though it's like really dated, like at, what is it, 40 years old? Completely holds up. Really good movie.
I have a non-plot question, which is, can you think of any other situation where you had a prominent filmmaker who was returning to their IP or something that they created, and the end result was more disappointing than this?
Star Wars?
The two that came to mind to me were the Star Wars prequel trilogy, directed by Lucas, and then maybe Godfather 3. But he already made the first two Godfather, so maybe he gets a pass on that one in terms of Coppola.
I don't agree. Yeah. I think Godfather 3 is it's not nearly as bad as people make it out to be.
Yeah, I agree.
Actually, Marcus, though, that's a good point. I think that you win with the Lucas call out there.
Yeah, we just watched the Return of the Jedi with our kids. Like, oh, that's all the movies they made.
no more Star Wars. Oh, you can show them Rogue One, I guess.
Yeah. They love the Ewoks. Huge, huge hit. Ewoks were like the best ever.
All right, Colin, what else you got?
I have a general question. What's the alien's like gestation cycle? When is it a facehugger? When is it like an alien? What does it need to transform between one and the other?
It varies by movie based on the plot that they need to occur.
Okay. So
it is not consistent.
Okay. That's what I was wondering, because like, I'm like, wait a minute. Like, shouldn't it be like sometimes when it comes out of the stomach, it's like Michigan J. Frog?
Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, my raccoon gal.
That's so fantastic. Yeah, but like it definitely seems inconsistent. So if I'm not missing something, then that's fine. If it's not been defined well.
Well, I think Dave has it right, but also just remember that the organisms in this movie are not the same as the xenomorphs in Alien or Aliens.
Yeah. Well, we talked about it in Alien 3, and we said, okay, the fully grown xenomorph, right, based is itself on the DNA that it's digesting.
Of the host. Yeah.
Correct.
Host.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it can. I understand how that can change, but it's also like, okay, at what point is it a facehugger, and what point does it like?
So here's what I think, just based on off of this movie and my knowledge of the other ones, but we'll talk about it in the context of Prometheus. If you get the black goo in you, then you birth a facehugger, which then will latch onto a host and implant the egg with the xenomorph type creature.
And then what are the eggs?
Those are laid by the xenomorph queen.
The queen.
Right, but which we
So then every so often a xenomorph comes out of a host and it's a queen and then can lay eggs?
Yes.
So this movie, there are no xenomorphs and there are no eggs. You've got crazy creatures like the trilobite. Okay, so if you remember back, Holloway gets the black goo. He then has sex with Shaw. Shaw now has this quote-unquote fetus inside of her, which grows into...
That barely tracks even for the alien mythology, honestly.
We'll talk about it. That grows into a trilobite, which is sort of like a huge version of the facehugger.
Okay.
But not the same thing as. And then it implants whatever into the engineer at the end, and out comes a creature that is like a cousin to the xenomorph. It's called the Deacon because of the shape of its head. It's like a deacon's hat.
Hmm.
Those creatures then in Alien Covenant, what happens is David does a shitload of experimentation on this species and ends up creating sort of the perfect version of it, which is the xenomorph and the egg and the xenomorph creature. And so that's how you get to that particular creature that then shows up in Alien.
All right.
But I don't think that was the original intent for the sequel. I think they just were like, all right, let's just figure out a way to create the xenomorph.
Exactly.
People want the xenomorph. We'll give them the xenomorph.
And they got the xenomorph for a good 10 to 12 seconds before the credits rolled in.
No, not the xenomorph is not in this movie, Dave.
It's the closest thing to the xenomorph in this movie.
Yes, it's the closest thing to, but it's not.
All right. What else you got, Colin?
More bad writing. Maybe I'm wrong. So this is why I have a question. So what led them to this planet? Well, it was all these cave drawings that they found, right? The same cave drawing with these humans who are worshiping this very large figure who's pointing up to, you know, six stars in the sky. And so Shaw and Holloway say, you know, well, this is an invitation. These are like our creators. I don't know how they got creators out of it. Could have just been like, you know, really tall aliens. But they say this is an invitation to come meet your maker, right? Well,
horseshit.
I don't, this is what I, yeah. I found that this is a very interesting beginning to the movie. I think this is really, they're onto something here. As just as a scientific plot device, it's like, I want to know more.
Let me ask you this though. So
yes,
if the engineer sacrificed himself, right? His body melted basically, and you know that basically his DNA was then seeded into the world. Yeah, how would they ever see somebody who was pointing at the stars or know that where the stars were?
Okay, I'll talk about that in a sec. So he's pointing up to these stars, right? Like, oh, it's an invitation. Come find us. Well, where is he pointing at? They say he's pointing at essentially this one star system, which they have found, and there's a sun, and it's much like our own, and there's a moon around a planet that's the only thing that could support life like our own. So that must be where they live, and that's where they go. But as we find out, that's not their home world. It's actually this bioweapons facility that only a few engineers go to because this pathogen is so, you know, like awful, it would like kill everyone. Why are they inviting proto humans to go to this bioweapons facility?
Here's the thing. Just try to explain to me in any reasonable terms how the person that made the cave painting would in any way be given the information that would compel them to put the drawing on the cave wall to begin with. Are we saying that it's within the DNA of the person and it's so powerful that it will create artistic images in their head? Is that what they're going for here?
It's much simpler than that. All right. So you have to do a little research into this to understand what's happening, because they cut it all out of the goddamn movie. So the way that I understand it from original scripts...
No, I'm asking about this movie, like within the context of just this movie. Right. How does it work within this movie? Not stuff that was produced or stuff that was written in a previous draft. I'm saying it's like, explain it to me.
I'll say how it works within this movie. So the sacrificial engineer, you know, like he sacrifices himself at the beginning of this movie to put his DNA into Earth, our world. And then over, you know, millions of years, humans evolve. And over the course of those millions of years, the engineers would come back and check on humanity and see how we're doing. And that's what is depicted in those cave paintings, that there was contact between the engineers and humankind. But it stopped, you know, thousands of years ago.
Well, so I did a little bit of research just because I was curious about this question. Do you know who the engineer was that they sent back to Earth 2,000 years ago?
Yes, I do.
Who was it?
His name was Jesus H. Christ.
There you go. So I don't recall Jesus delivering the Sermon on the Mount and saying, you should go forth and go to the moon on the third planet of the blah, blah, blah somewhere to go find. I mean, do you see anything in the Bible that refers to the secret bioweapons lab? I mean, come on.
But let me explain that one. So
you can't fucking explain this, dude.
I can't.
This movie's beyond fucking stupid, dude. You're reaching.
No, I can explain it because for whatever reason, they cut this stuff out. So there's an extended conversation that happens between the engineer that they revive and Wayland and David at the end. And for whatever reason, when you watch the movie, they wake up the engineer, they ask him a question, they assault Shaw in the process, and before the alien answers anything, he just attacks them and kills them, and he rips David's head off. it's like, well, why don't we get to have some sort of conversation? Well, they actually did have it. They filmed it and they cut it out. And ultimately, what was, they originally had like 5 pages of dialogue. And essentially, why do you think the engineers are going to destroy humanity? Like, just why do you think that? Because that's what they're doing, right? At the end of the movie, they were going to go 2,000 years ago, they were going to destroy humanity with this with the black goo, and then they just got overrun by the creatures, and their mission stopped. And so when they revive the engineer is like, I'm going to complete my mission. I'm going to go destroy Earth. So why did the engineers want to destroy Earth 2,000 years ago?
Because they were disappointed in the evolution of humanity and things we were doing to the planet, etc. They decided that they should take another run and start over.
Right. And so basically what happens with this old Jesus character is that supposedly their home world, the engineer's home world, is called Paradise. And they created life on Earth. And it was like an Eden. It was, they tried this many times. And the only place it actually worked was Earth. No, I'm just telling you what I read. I mean, it doesn't excuse the movie because the movie cuts all this stuff out. But this is really interesting stuff. And I think, feel like they should have kept it in there. Although I understand maybe why this part they cut out, because this is like, wait, what? So they, basically 2,000 years ago, things were not going well. Humans were barbaric. They were warlike, violent. So the engineers plucked a human baby out and took him back to their home world. And they trained him all about love and creation and all this stuff. And then they brought him back and he was supposed to spread the word, spread the message. And that's the whole Jesus. And then what happened? Well, you know, humankind punished him and they crucified him. And that's when the engineer said, all right, that's it. We're going to destroy this. But they're a lost cause, which I thought was really interesting. But I understand why they cut it out, because you would be rolling your eyes if that was what came out on screen.
I'm rolling my eyes at your explanation now, dude.
Look, I'm not saying I agree with it or anything. I think it's a really interesting story. But that at least explains like why the engineer was so pissed off at the end.
It's kind of, yeah. I think that would be a hard movie to sell. Having Jesus be an alien.
Yes, it would. Jesus was not an alien. He was not an engineer. He was human.
Oh, he's raised by aliens.
He was just raised by the aliens on Paradise.
Yeah, I'm not.
All right, well, you want to jump into this thing?
Let's do it.
All right, so just a few key scenes and maybe some questions as we go through this. I have one question up front, which is, when the engineer lands on Earth originally, so by the way, just a really good example of where the opening visuals of that scene in terms of the water flowing and the location, I think it might have been filmed in Iceland. It all looks really interesting and compelling, and it's just the visuals across the board in this movie are great. So that's the one thing. It makes it tolerable, I guess, to watch it because the visuals are cool. But I do have a question. So, you know, he opens up this canister and then he ingests it and then he dies, but he looks surprised. Do you think he looks surprised when he's dying, or is he just in pain there? Because doesn't he know that he's going to die when he's ingesting the black goo?
Yeah, I think you're right. He does look surprised, but yeah. Maybe it's more the surprise that
the level of pain,
and what it's doing to him. This I question, like, how is it that this tearing, like basically incinerating your body, how is that supposed to like seed the planet with your DNA? That makes no sense to me. I really don't get that. Also, why are you releasing the black goo on this planet? Like, conceivably, it could stay there, even though there are no other plants or animals. There are no humans. How long ago was
he on
this?
Earth, or where was he? He was on that moon, though. He was on Earth?
Yeah. No, he's on Earth.
No, this is, okay. I mean, I believe it's supposed to be Earth.
Yeah.
There's no human life there, but is there any life there? How long ago is this?
Well, so I thought this was actually the genesis of life on Earth. I think that's what they were trying to show you here.
Literally the genesis of all life on Earth. Because this is like hundreds of millions of years ago then.
Yeah, exactly.
Are the engineers really that old?
Yes.
Well, you seem very certain of that.
Well, I mean, it's the whole, they talk about the fact that
why do they look the same? Why haven't they changed in 100 million years?
Because they're apex in their form. I have no idea. Dude, you're asking me to, I'm not defending this fucking movie, by the way. So
I'm asking you to.
No, I'm just saying that I think that's what they're showing there, right? It's this is how they seeded life on Earth.
I don't think it's life. I think it'd be like, then how do you explain dinosaurs, all sorts of other things? Like, I think it's like 45,000 years ago and like the starting of mankind. I'll give it, but it still doesn't work.
Well, then you have to deal with, you know, when the asteroid hit the Yucatan Peninsula and, you know, what happened with that. So,
yeah,
if you,
I think it's human life, and I think it's like 10 million years ago, but I still think that 10 million years is quite a long time for, you know, the engineers to change.
So I'm actually super confused then as to what you thought was going on here. Like, how long ago do you think they were there and what do you think they were doing?
Well, no, I always thought it was that they were seeding Earth with human life. And not all life, but just human life, maybe. But when you look at the actual number of years, that would have been like 10 million years ago.
Right.
Think about that. Like, where are we going to be in 10 million years? I don't think we're going to be like we are today. Just think about evolution. I find it hard to believe that they would have lasted that long and not even changed. Anyway, these are all interesting questions. So I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm just saying that I have these questions because I like it. I think it's a great way to start this movie.
Yeah, and the ship hanging in the fog is a little bit of the similar to the Independence Day ship, and then it becomes the Arrival ship as well. That's what I noticed. So it's horizontal, and then it goes vertical,
right,
and then it disappears. But again, all the visuals here are really great, and the visuals throughout this movie are super compelling. So that's one thing that if you ask me, what did I like about this movie? That would be it: the visuals. Yeah, so moving forward a bit, so I think we talked about the cave painting, but again, I have no idea exactly how you look at that and go, oh yeah, that's that star system, but okay, whatever.
I think they tried it.
Yeah, different civilizations, had different maps, blah, 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 it's fucking stupid. I mean,
they plugged the star systems into the computer, and then they said like they finally, like it took them a while to determine it. I agree, it's thin. What's the precision on like cave drawings?
Right, exactly.
like your mark on the wall is
well,
not
that's true. Yeah.
You know,
but that's sort of like to me, this is somewhat of a callback to like something like Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah, it's a good plot. I think I like it as a plot device, to be honest. I do think it's a little bit thin, but like it kind of works.
Yeah, conceptually, it's good.
Yeah, I don't mind the concept. I just think that the reality of the execution in terms of looking at five dots smeared on a wall 10,000 years ago. And you're like, oh, that's definitely LV-329 or whatever it is.
Well, come on. They're in the cave. And there's like, oh my God, here's even more proof of what we think our theory is.
Right.
I liked it. And that cave painting is 35,000 years old. And that is basically the age of the oldest cave painting that we've ever found.
Wrong.
At least.
It's like 60,000 now.
What? Where?
In La Pasega Cave in Spain. 64,800 years ago.
Oh, I only had the Altamira cave in Spain 35,600 years ago. How many stars were painted on that cave?
That was only four, so it's got to be different.
So then you see it cuts to the ship and it's flying along, and this is where you're introduced to David, the android. And it is interesting seeing the activities that he's doing throughout the day. So actually, I had one question here. Do you think the solitude over the 2-year period is what actually drove him slightly insane? Is that, do you think there's anything to that? Or do you think he was happy to spend his 2 years playing basketball and riding bikes and strangely looking into people's minds as they slept? Because that would make you feel comfortable.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because as an android, he shouldn't have that feeling of boredom and isolation.
But then they show him doing a series of activities as if he is looking to try and fill the time, right?
Yeah.
Well, killing the time, I think he's taking the opportunity to learn. I think maybe that time period just alone, and then how he's treated afterward by when all the humans wake up is that, you know, I am far superior to this. I learned a whole language. I can understand the engineers, because I've been studying this past 2.5 years, And what do you guys treat me like, you know, I'm the butler.
How good do you think he got at basketball?
I think he should have tried out for the Harlem Globetrotters.
So it moves on to they're arriving at the planet and people start waking up. And I mentioned this earlier, but I do think that the Vickers moment where, you know, she jumps out and she starts doing push-ups right away, I really feel like they're trying to pull a little bit of the Vasquez energy from Aliens into that moment. It's just, it's, you know, they're trying to make, they give Vickers an edge as if Vickers like the badass or, you know, she's fierce or whatever. But then she doesn't take command of the mission at any point. So it's a weird kind of, it's like, okay, here's her innate personality, but she doesn't translate that to leadership. So I don't know. I just think that the Vickers character, I think, just doesn't really work here. I think that's really what it comes down to. But I do like that they use a Rubik's Cube as a projector. So I thought the prop master got out pretty easy on that one.
I know it's like bad move because that's immediately what you think of is it's a Rubik's Cube.
And then I guess the other thing on that is I do think that the visual or the experience that they create where they have Wayland actually giving the briefing as if he's there, that's a cool effect, right? The blending of the digital reality that he recorded it in and how it is overlaid into reality. That's an example of where I think the visuals are pretty cool. And conceptually, right, that would be fun and interesting to see if you were ever going to watch a presentation from somebody. So I did like that.
Yeah. Most of the graphics that they sort of created with the holograms are really quite cool.
Definitely a step up from R2-D2. Yeah.
But then there is a scene after this where they go and they meet with Vickers with the, you know, a couple of the scientists. And this is where she tries to assert a certain level of dominance in terms of her saying that she's in control of the mission. And then one of the questions the character asks is there an agenda you're not telling us about? I mean, come on, from a dialogue standpoint in a script.
No, I know.
By the way, in this movie, is there a hidden agenda that you're not telling us about? I mean, come on. That's a terrible, terrible piece of dialogue.
Did Vickers say that to the scientists? Or is it other way around?
The scientists said it to Vickers.
Oh, okay.
So she could respond, my company raised $1 trillion to bring you here, you know, whatever.
That's just sloppy writing. You're right.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Also, the foreshadowing. Oh, look over here. It's a polymed pod.
Right.
I guess we're going to see that later on.
Yeah. It's, hey, what is that? There's only 5 of those in the world. Just the exposition is super clunky.
Yeah.
Across the board. And when they arrive at the planet, too, I do appreciate the fact that of the entire planet or moon, I guess, that they can land on, they happen to pick the exact spot where they're the alien pyramids or whatever you want to call those things. So imagine if you were just going to a random planet, what are the odds that you're going to just land in the exact spot? Because they don't mention any kind of like a beacon, or they didn't do any survey, or there's no information given to in any way sort of justify the fact that they land at the exact right spot.
Yeah, I don't recall if there was like something, a scan or anything but
they were already pretty close. Like it'd be like you're flying over California, you'd notice one of the mountains or something. Oh, over there, that's interesting. Like they're still pretty close, like considering how big it was.
What I want to know is why, if you're flying through an alien world through some pretty massive storms, why are you standing at the pilot station and not getting strapped in when everyone else is strapped in?
And also, like, it seems like a way more logical. You'd, like, orbit the moon a few times, scan it.
Right.
I don't know. Like, the whole thing, like.
I guess the frustrating thing here is, and this is where it gets back to just how terrible this script is. They could have easily justified that to say, you know, they had the briefing, and in the next 2 days, you know, we'll spend some time orbiting, scanning. You guys prep your drop mission or whatever, right? Yeah. And then you cut to like when they're going to go. And then, okay, problem resolved, at least in terms of a little bit of the logic, right? But yeah. No, they don't go that direction.
Yeah, you don't have to show that 2 days. I mean, you can just have them.
Exactly.
Like, okay, like then you can do like the diner scene or do whatever scene you want to do, like the mess hall.
Yeah.
You can do a couple of things of them getting ready for it. But yeah.
I will say the visual of the ship coming in through the atmosphere is, again, quite beautiful. So I think the visuals of the planet and the ship and all that, it's all very well done. I think it looks quite nice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's beautiful. I love in the atmosphere, you see this enormous planet with a giant ring around it. It's very, very cool. So they really nailed all of the special effects in this movie.
And then we kind of talked about this before, but the Janik versus Vickers command structure question. So Janik is in charge of the ship. He's the captain of the ship. Vickers is in charge of the overall mission. But Vickers really has no command authority that is ever executed in the film at any point in time, right?
No, considering it seems like Holloway is the one who's like, okay, we're going down there now. Okay, let's go.
Right, I was going to say, because that's what that leads to. They land the ship on the planet, right? Nobody's done any survey about, you know, weather, seismic activities, hostile life,
yep,
atmospheric conditions. Nope. Holloway says, it's Christmas and I want to unwrap my gifts. Everybody jump on the thing and let's drive to the pyramid. So they're out the door in 15 minutes, which is so incredibly ludicrous. I understand you need to compress the time of the movie, but come on, man. I mean, that is just an example of this script being so fucking stupid.
So here's a guy who's, it's all about risk, risk, risk. And then somebody grabs a weapon and it's all of a sudden it's like, hey, this is a scientific expedition. No weapons. It's like, what? Come on, dude. You have no idea what's waiting for you down there.
Yeah.
This guy, just want to slap him.
By the way, just one general question there. So it seems like everybody always has a flamethrower on these missions for, you know, in all these scientific movies. But I'm not sure I've seen a lot of flamethrowers just casually being used just on a daily basis. So it's interesting that the flamethrower always shows up as the primary weapon. And I obviously there's a callback to Aliens, yes, and even what they rigged up in Alien. But I don't know, just the presence of the flamethrower is kind of funny.
Well, you just nailed it. It would not be an Alien movie without some flamethrowers.
But right. Also, the whole movie's blue and you get it pop some orange in there and it looks just awesome. So.
Yeah, well, whatever. It looks cool.
Oh, come on. We got Fifield's head.
So one thing that I will give him props for, so when they get to the when they get to the pyramid structure and they send out those little scanning devices, that I think is actually pretty cool. And the visual that gets built as they're traveling around and the whole concept of the fact that you could send these, you know, floating laser scan devices to give you a really accurate reading of the entire structure. A little bit confused, by the way, as to why you can't use that to just find your way out of the structure later, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah. But
wouldn't you
want
to do that even before you go into, like, just shoot that from the ship, let it map
exactly.
It out.
Exactly. Right. Let's go map things out. But then they get inside the pyramid, and this is the part for the when I was watching this movie the first time where I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me, right? Which is,
they take off the helmet.
They take off their helmets in terms of the atmosphere, like, oh, this air is breathable, right? No one's done a sensor scan. No one's checked for bacterial, you know, concentrations or.
Yeah,
you know, trace gases, whatever it is, right?
But also, like, what made me think of was the Europeans landing in North America. It's same environment, like, but they brought along disease and death. So it's very, very similar in that regard. Of like, how could you just trust this no matter what? Like, how do you know you won't catch?
Yeah, I mean,
you might catch the aliens, right? Or what they end up like, which they end up doing, right? Like, it's very similar to that.
It's an indefensible act from the characters. It's just you can't. Yeah. Then they're supposed to be scientists. I mean, come on. It's just then that's an example of why I find this movie annoying. And then the whole what's his name? So Fifield, the geologist. Like this guy just he's supposed to be a geologist. He looks like a mercenary or a terrorist from some other movie that they rolled into this one and said, hey, can you play a scientist? I mean, that's and I think he carried over his character actions from the previous film into this one. So he's a little confused as to whose character is supposed to be.
He has a large tattoo on the side of his head. Of course, he's unstable.
Yeah. But then, OK, so they find the body of the engineer.
Let me talk about here just for a sec, just because. Yeah. You're going like, what is wrong with these guys? Who are they? You know, during the briefing, you know, they put out their whole theory with these, you know, different stone tablets and cave paintings and all this stuff. And what is Fifield say? So we're here because of a map? It's like, I'm so unimpressed. Who is this guy? Like, like also, if you're going to do that and you're going to have these characters that are just ridiculous. I'm like, who is he? Like, is he security or something? Like, no, he's the geologist. And the other guy, Milburn, he's the biologist. And they're the dumbest people on Earth. And so, like...
Yeah, maybe have the geologist drop one line about the structure or something like that, you know? I mean, in terms of, oh, this is a such and such type of material, or something.
His responsibility is for mapping the place. And so, of course, he gets lost.
Right.
If you're going to do that, at least have some sort of backstory to give an explanation, some sort of motivation, something that makes us reasonably believe why he's acting that way. But they don't do it. And I read some stuff later on that said why he's the way he is. And I'm like, great. None of that is in this movie. So why am I supposed to believe that?
These two guys are the stupidest fucking characters maybe in the history of film, honestly. They're up there. If you think about what their pedigree is supposed to be in terms of scientists, a geologist, and a biologist, what does the biologist do? He's like, oh, there's an alien creature. I bet I should go pet it. And then, the geologist, it's like his idea so is bad. Like he just freaks out and runs. And again, his mapping technology, and he gets lost. I mean, it's maddeningly stupid.
Not only that, but Milburn, the biologist, he goes from being super scared to now seeing an alien life form that looks fairly threatening and treating it like its pet.
It looks like a cobra. It's all like spread out.
If I saw that thing pop out, the first thing I would do is run my ass out of the room.
Then send
in some probes or a camera or whatever to try to figure out, what it might be. But let me
try to pet you.
We're jumping ahead a little bit on that one. But one of the questions I had too, so David shows up and he apparently can, I guess you assume that the 2 years he spent studying the language or whatever, he can communicate. But the scientists are there and he just walks up and opens the door by himself. He's like, okay, let me fire this thing up and just open it up. So nobody is, there's no command structure on this mission whatsoever. Everybody's just like, hey, here's the plan. Let's go to the pyramid. Everybody just do what you feel. that's the mission plan. just express yourself scientifically.
What's going on with this movie? I purposely chose this because I like it, but I know that there's a lot of really dumb stuff in it, and that's why I thought it would be fun to discuss. Now I'm really getting pissed off.
Well, so the thing is, so they do have the two guys, and they're wandering around the interior of the pyramid. And again, the guy that has the mapping technology manages to get lost. So they, again, practicing the best biological containment protocols you have as scientists, they find an engineer's head, and they throw it in a bag, and they bring it on board the ship, and they bring it into a room where no one's wearing containment suits. And they then, their process on this one is to find a piece of metal and shove it in there. So by the way, you know what this reminded me of? Remember when Bishop's body was on the junk pile in Alien 3 and Ripley walked up and stuck in a couple of like probes and then all of a sudden, Bishop could talk? You get a little bit of that here in terms of they just jam a piece of metal into the side of his head and start shooting volts into his head to try to resurrect it or do something with it. I'm not quite sure what their intent is.
Well, this was just bullshit. So you got this 2,000-year-old body and you think you can, quote unquote, trick the nervous system into thinking it's still alive?
Really? That's so dumb.
Those neurons are dead, honey. It's not happening. But it's an interesting idea because you get to then see the pathogen working. But really, come on.
Well, I would imagine that there must be biology students that are out there or scientists that watch this movie just with a few beers and just have a great time. Because the other thing is that David has taken one of the containers of the black goo and he brings it on the ship and he just jams it in what appears to be a standard refrigerator, like with other stuff inside the lab. And he just sticks it in there. And that's where he gets the black goo to then, he puts it in Holloway's drink to try and contaminate him. I have a question here, which is how did David know to do that? Or what was the indicator that would be the path that he should take to try to, start the xenomorph cycle happening? I mean, there's nothing. I don't know. Your thoughts there?
I do have thoughts before we get there, though. I just want to go back to the head for a second. Aside from the fact that you're playing Reanimator, you just made like probably the most momentous discovery in the history of mankind, and actually now you've got evidence of real aliens. You have its head, and then you just accidentally destroy it.
Blown up. It was blown up.
Oops. Oh my God. Okay, so motivations. David, if you haven't noticed yet, has got little regard for
the people
around him.
I totally get that. I'm just saying, it's like, how would he know? So, how would he know to use the black goo to do that specifically? That's what I'm asking.
Well, he doesn't. He doesn't know that, but there's one good way to find out, which is to do a little experiment.
He's just running a test. That's fair.
He's experimenting. So that scene where David infects Holloway, I just think this is like, this is sort of one of the standout scenes because Holloway is such a, and this is where I blame Logan Marshall Green maybe, because he plays him so like petulant and he's like, he's just sulking. He's so upset. He's made the greatest discovery in human history and he's just sitting there sulking. They find one engineer's body and they just assume that they're all dead. Like, that's it. It's over. Why'd we come all this way?
Right. And so here's all this amazing potential, you know, technology, or obviously the, you know, you could spend a lifetime studying just the structures and try to figure things
archaeology
out.
Archaeology or like,
yeah. I mean, it's right. It's the greatest discovery in the history of mankind. And he is walking around like, you know, he just got dumped as a 15-year-old or something like that. I mean, it's just, it's the most, it's the most bizarre energy. Like, I don't understand why. And then he's having an argument, by the way, with Shaw, and his main frustration is, it's like, well, I wanted to meet our makers. It's like, anybody can create life. Like, what? And then, of course, then she can't because, you know, she has an issue with being unable to conceive. And so those two things, like tying those things together and having that be a line of exposition and then having her, of course, become pregnant through this, it's just, it's horrible. I mean, this Holloway and his motivations and his what he's saying during this whole exchange is, it's just garbage. It's terrible.
Yeah, I agree, which is probably one of the reasons why David chose him to experiment on.
Well, I don't have a problem with that, like, actually. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, David's pretty annoyed. So basically, you know, Holloway just immediately accepts that engineers made humans based off of, you know, whatever empirical data that they found. But it's, you know, we didn't get to meet them. And so he's just all pissed off. And David says, why did your people make me? Well, we made you because we could. Well, can you imagine how disappointing it would be for you to hear the same thing from your creator? And it's like, dude, you are in for it.
Yeah. And then it cuts back to, so you have Milburn and Feifeld. And again, this is where, you know, they're in the cave. And so they have Feifeld and he has his helmet on and he's using a vaping device inside his helmet. Is that... So I had a question there. Is the suit designed for that or did he jury-rig something? I mean, how did he get that to happen? And by the way, when you have a limited amount of oxygen, the fact that you'd be sitting there vaping inside your suit and you're supposed to be a scientist with the level of discipline, it's so fucking stupid.
It makes no sense at all. But okay.
Yeah. And then we touched on this and this is where, you know, the cobra thing, cobra-looking thing pops up and... the biologist's response is as if it's a cute little kitten or something. And he says it's beautiful. And his first instinct is to lean in and try to play with it, which again, I see something pop up out of the goo somewhere. I'm running the other direction. We're sending the probes in. We're locking the place down. I mean, actually both these guys get what they deserve, honestly.
Like if you were like out on a hike in the desert on planet Earth, just, you know, and you saw something like that happen, it'd freak you out.
Oh my God,
completely.
I'd be getting the hell out of there. Are you kidding me? I'm not staying around.
Now imagine you're like trillions of miles away and the same thing. You'd be just like, yeah. I don't know how their reaction was so like.
I think I know.
Calm about it.
What? Now I get it. Because
he was high?
Yeah. You were just, he was vaping, but he was stoned to the bejesus belt.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. Maybe he was pumping some really good weed into his suit.
So I got to ask you a question. So when Shaw and Holloway were talking and he was being a clueless idiot, they end up making up and they have sex. He passes something to her. I'm curious to know what you think happened there.
I think what happened was some black goo got into his sperm and he shot that into her and then it manifested itself as the face hugger.
But did she get pregnant or is it just that his sperm is now inside her and then it starts growing?
Well, yeah, it could be either, I guess. But since the fact that the 3-month gestation period happens in a period of 20 minutes, I would assume that it's just sort of alien mambo jambo.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I think it's the latter. Because when you think about these creatures, you know, they rewrite your DNA. And so... ultimately, I think that this particular creature, we'll call it a trilobite, I think that is a like an alien version of his sperm. Like it's his sperm rewritten. And so that sort of like comes out a bit mutated and turns into this facehugger type trilobite creature.
By the way, how does that creature, without ingesting any additional material, grow to the mass that it does by the end of the movie?
Ask the engineers. I don't know.
Okay. I just had a question on that one. But okay. So they do go out on a rescue mission to, as Colin has in his notes here, going to find the idiots. And when they get to the when they get to the air pocket, again, everybody on the team just takes their helmet off, right? So got a couple lost guys, not sure what's going on. Let's just take our helmets off. So it falls apart so fast because Holloway is sick. And so he's sitting there and he looks sick. People can see him. And his response is, no, I'm okay. And they're like, all right, well, let's just try to keep going a little bit. It's like you're on an alien planet. Someone has like beet red eyes. Their face is starting to change. I'm thinking that at this point, maybe at least put your helmets on. I don't know. Just spitballing here.
Well, can he also like say like, oh yeah, I just saw this thing coming out of my eye.
Right.
Something living
in me. I had a little squiggly worm in my eye.
Yeah, you would think.
But what's great about that is when they're on their way back and Holloway is sick, you hear someone yell, full quarantine failsafe. And my question on that one was, now? After everything else they've done? Let's just bring a shitload of alien material onto the ship and then, oh wait, somebody actually got sick and so let's go ahead and initiate the quarantine. And then, so Vickers comes out and Vickers has the flamethrower and Holloway just steps forward and says, you know, go ahead and burn me. You know, if you're really going to go out, are you really going to sit there and let someone torch you with a flamethrower? I mean, come on. At that point, what I did is I looked out at the runtime on the film and I'm like, holy shit, I have 46 minutes of this movie left. That was my thought at that moment.
Yeah, but the last 46 minutes is really good.
Yeah. And then, by the way,
did you like the second half better?
I liked the first 40 minutes and the last 40 minutes. I thought they were really good.
All right. So one thing, when David goes in, he also accesses the engineers, I guess their map room or their navigation system. And I was a little curious about how he could move holograms around. So
I was wondering the same thing.
There's a holographic projection of the Earth, and at one point he grabs it and he moves it. Not quite sure how he could do that if it's a hologram, but whatever.
I'm pretty sure you can't.
So they get back, and this is where it's revealed that Shaw has the alien inside. And the whole process where David is looking at her is kind of great because he scans her, and then she says, I want to see it. And he says, oh, you better not do that. So again, chain of command here. The android is telling the lead scientist that you can't have access to the information of what's in your own body. So
that's
strange.
That's because
it's not exactly a traditional fetus.
David, he's got a little sarcasm to him. Okay, you want to know, David, do you have your own agenda? Because clearly he does.
Well, you think, and then he drops the line, you must feel like your God has abandoned you. Like, so that's like his casual bedside manner. Hey, you have a mutant fetus inside your body. Oh, I bet you feel like your God has abandoned you, huh? Okay, well, I'm going to go get some lunch. So
he's just trolling everyone.
Well, and then at that point she says, well, how do you know? And then he references something about her father or something like that. And she says, how do you know that? And he says, I watched your dreams. And at that point, if she doesn't, jump off the table and then bury an axe in his head. I mean, because if the idea that this android dude has been watching their dreams for 2 years while they've been on traveling, I mean, come on. There's a bit of a red flag there, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And then at this point, I think this is where Shaw runs to the pod. And I do think that the surgery scene it's a little gruesome, but it's pretty compelling. I like the way that it's done.
It's got good tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good scene. It definitely ramps up and it gets you to the edge of the seat. It's one of the better scenes in the whole movie.
It's probably the best
scene
in the movie, honestly, I guess, in terms of the tension and all that.
It is. I also like the foreshadowing. You know, I need a cesarean section, male patients only. Well, that's weird because this is Vickers' place.
Yeah. So she has the surgery and she gets the staples. I do think that her level of mobility immediately after the surgery is impressive. I referenced that earlier, but she's throwing on spacesuits and running and rappelling at one point. So she's in surprisingly good shape for just having the equivalent of a C-section. And then this is the big reveal. So what you find out is that Wayland has been on the ship the entire time and he's there and he wants to try and extend his life, which is the main reason why they're on this mission. So I had a question here though. So David is washing his feet, right, which is a direct reference to Jesus and Christianity and the washing of feet. So is that what they were going for there?
Well,
maybe. It's a religious reference for sure. Yeah. To some degree.
Like, yes, but I'm not sure exactly.
I think it's like your point earlier. It's like one of those references that kind of like, oh, this has like religious overtones, but there's no real like connected tissue to it all. It's just like, oh, we'll just throw these things in here and maybe it'll make some sense somehow.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is when Shaw comes running into the room, right? She's bloody. She's been stitched up. Not a single person in the room asks her what's going on or why do you have that large, why do you have that large cut across your abdomen? No, yeah. Nobody even references it.
I just gave birth to an alien. Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah,
that's cool. I'm going to keep washing my this guy's feet. So.
Well, I mean, David doesn't give a shit. And he also, he can put two and two together. And then Wayland is like coming out of cryosleep shock. I didn't actually ask that question myself.
Well, and the other thing is she is still wearing her cryo-freeze underwear. And she is throughout the film. So does this entire mission go to shit in like 12 hours? Is that what we're looking at here in terms of the total time? Do they land on the planet and no one even changes their underwear before they're all dead? Is that really what happens? I mean, honestly, is it 24 hours? I mean,
I don't know. I think that's somewhat of a callback to Alien when Ripley strips down to get into the spacesuit and she's in her skivvies, and you know.
But I do think timeline wise, I think you're right. I think they like because they get there from when they wake up to when they land is not that long.
15 minutes. They're on the. Like, they're on the tractors.
You travel 2.5 years, 3, I just want to reiterate this, 327 trillion miles, and you fail in less than 12 hours.
Right, yeah.
That's spectacular.
Yeah, that's well done, team. And based on this team and their actions, that seems about right, actually. So I think maybe bring a higher quality of scientists with you next time. That'd be my recommendation. And then one question about just the interaction between...
They should have used ZipRecruiter. And now a word from our sponsor.
Come on, ZipRecruiter, you can do it. So one question. So Vickers ends up at one point smelling her father's hand when he's sitting there. And she has some concerns. But by the way, the great thing about this is she is on the mission with him. And her frustration is that he is trying to find a way to extend his life to, you assume, maintain ownership over the company. And she says something like, oh, you know, when the king's reign is over, it's time for him to go or something like that. But she came on this mission voluntarily and without him knowing. So do you think the best way that she could have taken power of the company back in the day is maybe not go on the mission at all and send her, you know, 120-year-old dad off on some insane suicide mission to go meet with engineers on a foreign planet? Wouldn't that have been a better path for her to actually ascend to the leadership role of the company?
Yes. And what are the odds that Wayland is going to leave and somehow survive the trip and then find immortal life? Pretty small, I think. I think she should have just stayed back on Earth and taken over the company.
Yeah, just kind of dumb.
Oh, Vickers. You know, there's a weird thing that David says to Vickers. He says, doesn't everyone want their parents dead? No.
Yeah.
No, they don't. This just, to me, this is pretty clear cut that David is a psychopath.
There's a lot of quotes just kind of dropped in, which are like strange from David, but even from all the crew and stuff too. Just sometimes to create, one must destroy.
Yeah, I mean, the real crazy thing there too is it, like, so they've gone through this process. You have the Wayland reveal. I mean, Colin, you talked about this a little bit earlier, but it gets to the scene where they find the engineer. There's whatever, some interaction where, I don't know, Feifeld comes back and he's like some mutant guy and they fight him in the, which is like a total pointless action movie tack on sequence that has no relevance to the rest of the movie whatsoever. So it's just super clunkily kind of jammed in there just to have some moment of excitement, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. It turns into a monster movie.
It's just dumb, right? I mean, it's just because they haven't set up the mythology of, you know, why he would be, you know, looking like that relative to the black goo gets in someone else and they transform. So it's just bullshit, but. Yeah, so it doesn't even follow their own mythology. But getting past that, the interesting thing is you have Wayland resurrected, you have all these concepts at play, and so you have the engineer that then they are able to wake up, and so you think that this would be the moment where you'd have some back and forth exposition and have this thematic conversation about life or creation or any of that kind of stuff. And nope, he just tears David's head off and then smashes Wayland and that's it. And then, you know, jumps to complete his mission.
You get no answers. I mean, you get no answers to the big questions that they were asking.
Yeah, it's incredibly anticlimactic for the themes that they've been trying to drive throughout the rest of the film.
I totally agree. I just, sure, they didn't have to do the 5-minute speech about, you know, how Jesus came to the engineer's world of paradise and brought back these concepts to Earth and was promptly crucified. No, but they at least did on the, I guess on the Blu-ray, they had a deleted scene where they had like a 2-minute conversation. And I think a Wayland.
With the engineer.
And Wayland says, you know, tell them we came like they asked. And then the engineer asks why he wants to live forever. And Wayland says, like, I made David in my own image. I deserve this. We are creators. We are gods, and gods never die. And at that point, Shaw starts, you know, asking these questions. And then one of the henchmen hits her. At that point, you know, the engineer has seen enough. I'm woken up after, I don't know, 2,000 years, and all of a sudden I get these little tiny humans in front of me, and they're being violent. So just like, this is why we're going to destroy them.
Yeah.
I get it, but you could have come to that conclusion a lot easier if they just had a little bit of that engineer conversation. And it's so disappointing. I felt like there might have been that when I rewatched it again, and there was nothing.
It's very abrupt for... If the movie has been building this to be the sort of the climactic moment, it falls super flat. So then they start to blast off to Earth after the engineer or you know. And by the way, another thing I thought was kind of interesting. I mean, maybe it's actually a sign of dedication, but you wake up after 2,000 years and you jump in the pilot's chair to take your ship to Earth to go bomb Earth. Like you're up and going in 2 minutes. I mean, way to stay on point. Follow your mission parameters. It just, that seems to me a little bit strange, but okay.
You don't go to the bathroom, get a cup of coffee.
It's like, you know, just wake yourself up a little bit. I mean, I don't know. But then as they blast off, I do like, there is one moment at this movie that almost redeemed it. Do you know what that moment is for me personally?
Ramming speed?
It's where, he yells, hands up, when the three of them are committing suicide. he just randomly, out of nowhere, yells, hands up, that. And all three guys put their hands up as they're smashing the ship and on their suicide mission. That I liked. That I'll give him credit for, because I started laughing. I'm like, okay, there's a little moment of weird humor or something, I don't know. but I do, again, we mentioned this earlier, but I do think that Janik is able to convince his compatriots to throw their lives away very casually. Like everyone's on the same Thorazine drip in this movie. Like even the guys, the pilots are like, yeah, whatever. Okay, we can kill ourselves. That sounds like something to do.
Let me ask you something about Janik. Why is it that he's the only one who can put all of the pieces into place and say, you know, this is like a facility for the production of weapons of mass destruction and they're coming to kill everyone on Earth?
Yeah, I had that as a question in terms of his ability to make that leap as well, right? Because I don't know that he hasn't necessarily been looking at anything in terms of studying the scientific data or the interior or anything like that. I mean, he's just been kind of playing it casual on the ship for the most part. So, yeah, I have no idea. I mean, it just seems like a leap to me.
Well, he's the smartest person on the ship then.
And it's Idris Elba, so I really like him. So, whatever. I'm bought in. And then the other thing is, so, after the ships collide and you have this great visual of this massive, you know, ship rolling onto the ground... What's the idea to run in the same direction that this thing?
I know, I had that too.
This thing is going to be falling, right? And versus like, there's
everyone who saw this movie was thinking the same.
Right, and so at one point she trips
and she rolls
like, you know, the equivalent of like 10 seconds a roll and gets out of the way. And this is after they've been running in the same direction for 90 seconds as the thing is slowly falling on them. It's just, this is bad filmmaking. It's so stupid.
Yeah.
Good, cool visual though. Cool visual in terms of the scale of the ship and all that. I mean, it looks good, but it's just so dumb.
It's very cool.
And then, by the way, so when David asks her for help, what's the scenario where she's actually going to help him after all the stuff that he's done? And then she doesn't even want to get home. She wants to go to the engineer's planet, and this is just because she wants to try to fulfill her. I mean, this ending is just fucking stupid.
He could fly the ship, right? I think that's why it's his value.
But maybe if she wanted to get home, I would understand that about why he would have to help her. But of course, why would she ever trust him? Because the first time she falls asleep, he just walks over and snaps her neck.
Well, first of all, she's
only bringing his head.
Yeah. I mean, she hasn't
I did love fixed that. Like, she shoves his head in the duffel bag.
Yeah, but no, she's bringing his body, too. I mean, she's lowering his body.
Yeah, but you could, like, you know, wait to fix him after he's flown the ship.
Yeah.
And then, of course, so you do have the creature that has amazingly been able to gain its mass somehow, but moving past the questions for that.
Well, now that is established in the Alien franchise, is that the alien creatures, you know, grow incredibly quickly. So yeah. I think you just take it for what it is.
All right.
By the way, I really like this last scene because I was not expecting the engineer to come and try to find her. And all of a sudden you get this 9-foot engineer who's and this like 5-foot Shaw, and it's not going to be much of a battle. And then she like hits the button on the door that releases the trilobite creature, and it immediately gets its tentacles around the engineer. Now the engineer is fighting for his life. I thought that was great.
Yeah, yeah, I like that scene, and I liked her tactics in terms of opening the door. I thought that was good.
Yeah, I just love seeing the engineer now totally struggling, just like a puny human. Good stuff.
And then they, I guess, ultimately decide they're going to fly away and go to the engineer planet. And you see the xenomorph, as I mentioned at the end, although it's not quite the xenomorph, it's xenomorph-like. And roll credits, and thankfully, it's over.
Now, obviously, Shaw decides that she wants to go to the engineer's home world for the sequel. But I think after all of that, I think Earth would be my choice.
Right. I mean, truthfully, yeah. Under those circumstances, aren't you at least going to try to go back to Earth to get the information as to, you know, what you've at least learned a little bit in your 12 hours of chaos on the planet? So, yeah. Not that you've like recorded and it's like
yes,
actually captured any relevant information because all that got destroyed. But worst scientific team ever.
Yes.
Closing thoughts.
All right. Marcus, what did you learn from this movie?
I learned it's encouraging to all the C students out there. Even if you're not too smart, you can become a scientist and travel on important space missions.
Colin, what did you learn from this movie?
Don't insult an android who is far superior to you, because he just might infect you with a dangerous alien organism.
That's a good tip. What I learned is that in the future, we get stupider as a species, apparently, just across the board. And then the other thing I learned is that I think that you should not necessarily force a creator of a really interesting property back in the day back to try and take another run at it later in their life if they're really not feeling enthusiastic about it. Because I think you get this from Ridley Scott, and then I'll just, you know, Matrix Resurrections from the Wachowskis as an example, right? So I think that it's okay if you want to try to advance the IP, but find a different director. So this Fede Alvarez idea, for example, to see something in the Alien universe, great, love it, go for it. But I don't think we need any more Ridley Scott Alien movies.
Look, if Ridley Scott says he wants to do the Alien prequel, if I'm the studio, I'm like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Maybe just find a better writer.
Writer.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the takeaway that what I've learned is that you can take an amazing director who has an amazing command of visuals, and if you give him a shit script, it's still going to be a bad movie. That's what I
learned. Basically, yeah. They should have taken this. I mean, I don't mind that they got Damon Lindelof involved and everything, because I think he added quite a lot to it. But at that point, they should then given it to another script doctor, like, say, like Tony Gilroy, and had him do a pass on it. And then he would have cleaned up all that character junk. And then it could have been like a really good movie.
Yeah. Well, do you want to just continue on with your closing thoughts?
Yeah. all that being said, I love this movie, despite all of its stupid flaws. I don't love it. I like it a lot.
Love is a strong word.
It does have a lot of stupid flaws to it. I mean, it is typical Ridley Scott, just stunning scenery, stunning visuals. I love the surgery scene. I always think about it. They should have had more like that.
you just want to watch a bunch of surgeries?
Not a bunch of surgery, more scenes that actually had real tension, right?
Yeah, those felt cinematic, right?
Yeah. I like how the story itself raises all kinds of really big questions, because they're fun to ponder. It's just too bad that it's saddled with a lot of dumb characters who are behaving unreasonably and making stupid decisions. So ultimately, like, you know, it answers some of the questions, but poses a lot more. And I think in a good way, but I feel, unfortunately, that if you watch Alien Covenant, its sequel, you get let down. So that's not great. So all in all, I'm going to give this a B.
Marcus?
I echo much of the same. I like the overall story, the premise of it, I should say. Maybe not the story, but the premise is interesting. The creators in searching. Unfortunately, it's just not told that well. And it's the dialogue, the characters, they're just not really well written at all. It's beautifully shot, beautiful visuals. Like it's an interesting sci-fi movie in that regard. But yeah, overall, it just falls way short. I think the best way to watch it, just like kind of, I think we've said it before in other movies, take out your brain, sit back and just enjoy it. Don't try to think about it too much and just kind of enjoy the visuals and just roll with it. My letter grade, I'll give it a C.
Yes, I was not a huge fan of this film. So this movie is more than anything else. It's frustrating because Ridley Scott's a great director who I love. The visuals in this movie are pretty fantastic. The production design, the, you know, even like the vehicle design, the interiors, the all of the science, all the screens that you see, they all look fabulous. So it's super frustrating to me that you have that level of talent that gets applied to this movie. And then, you know, you staff this spaceship with the dumbest motherfuckers to ever appear in a science fiction film. I mean, it is the character actions or the actions that these characters take are the most insanely stupid. Obviously, you know, some like shitty B movie or whatever out there, like people are going to be doing dumb things, but you don't expect characters in a Ridley Scott film to behave this way. And so for me, it's just super annoying in that respect. And it pulls you out of the movie too much. And it unfortunately spoils what I think could have been something really interesting, because I would agree that the core concepts and the questions that are being asked here are very interesting. And so I think there's something there. I just think that the character motivations and the character actions are so fucking stupid. It drives me insane. And so for that reason, I will give this movie a D+, and I will likely never watch this film again.
But you will watch Edward Scissorhands again.
I would rather watch Prometheus than Edward Scissorhands. How about that?
There you go.
What grade did you give to Edward Scissorhands?
An F.
F. The revised grade is an F.
What was the original grade?
A B-.
B+. No, you said, it was a B-. I thought you gave it a B+.
It was a B+.
Oh, was it a B+? Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we are on to the pick or the movie selection, and this is my pick. And I had a bunch of movies on my list, and we're not doing any of those. I am inspired by a recent event at the Academy Awards where I thought an entitled actor was a complete dickbag, and so the movie that jumped into my head would be one that makes fun of actors being entitled dickbags. So the movie we're going to watch is Tropic Thunder.
Cool. That was on my list as a possibility. So this ought to be fun.
Yeah, I think this one will be fun.
I've never seen it.
I think we'll have to. The Robert Downey Jr. performance in this one it's the razor's edge. So I think it'll be a fun movie to talk about in that regard too. Looking forward to it. So we'll be back with Tropic Thunder. I hope you enjoyed our long conversation about the smartest crack scientific team to ever go out and explore and make major discoveries across the universe. That would be the crew of the Prometheus. And with that, this is the Real DMC Podcast, signing off. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye. My mom grabbed my hand halfway through the movie, and she like never let go. So that was my mom was my date for that movie.
Nice. That was a bonding moment for you. Did you score at the end of the night?
Oh, dude, that's just wrong.
Sorry, that was just a softball right down the middle of the plate. I couldn't resist.
Oh my goodness.